At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I spent the day reading transcripts of Fed meetings just so you don't have to. You're welcome, but we are still going to tell you about it. Also, the whys and wherefores of Treasury bills and a short story about the markets. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 21st of February. Great to have you with us. And I will tell you what, if you thought Supreme Court arguments on the radio were special, you ain't heard nothing till you've heard Federal Reserve meetings. And not just any Fed meetings either. Today, the central bank released the transcripts of its 2008 get-togethers, word for word what the Federal Open Market Committee knew and when they knew it as the economy was falling apart. I will admit, going to sound like a total nerd for saying this, but it's really great reading, kind of like deja vu all over again, and not without its lighter moments. This, for instance, from the September 16th meeting, that is, a day after Lehman Brothers went under. They started editing the statement they were going to issue when the meeting was done, as they do every meeting, and they got hung up on the word closely, as in, the committee will closely monitor developments. Chairman Bernanke, near the end of the meeting, said, and I quote, "We have 17 people debating over this word, and it actually does matter. Does anybody else want to weigh in?" Oh, yes, they did. Also considered, instead of closely, were keenly, carefully, and in a timely manner, as well as a discussion of whether they were going to use adjectives or adverbs. I kid you not. They went with carefully, by the way. We are going to start with the Fed as we try to wrap up the week that was. Felix Salmon from Reuters and Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post are in our New York bureau. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, acknowledging that they were doing this in real time, and as you peruse either the minutes or summaries thereof, the transcripts, rather, what's your sense of how they did?
You kind of get the sense that they were like in the middle of a car wreck. And I think Bernanke actually used this phrasing at some point in a speech recently, that they're kind of at points just trying to keep from driving off the bridge, and they're not really aware of the gravity of the situation. And then in retrospect, they can look back and say, wow, that was actually really, really scary.
We survived.
Yeah. Right, I mean, you also get the sense that some of them were a little bit more nonchalant.
Right.
About how difficult things were.
So some of them actually wanted to raise rates in
2008, yeah, no, I know.
Which
I know.
Blows my mind. And I think the main lesson which I take from all this is that they had no idea how serious it was.
Right.
The credit crisis starts in 2007. Bear Stearns goes bust in March 2008. And even through the fall and summer of 2008, they think the economy is growing when
after
it is not.
After Lehman. Well, yeah,
Bernanke actually says, the day after Lehman Brothers, Bernanke says, I think our policies are actually working pretty well here.
They think that what they do is they react to the financial crisis with these financial tools. They throw liquidity into the banking system. But they don't cut rates because they think the broader economy is actually okay.
Catherine, on that point, were they thinking about the right things? If you do a word cloud, and I'm sure this is out there somewhere, over all of 2008, inflation is mentioned, wait a minute, where is it? 2,664 times. Unemployment is mentioned 275 times. I mean, you know.
Well, I'm not sure that's the best comparison right now because employment was not super scary at that time.
No, but it had
the following year.
Yeah, but it had already started going down, right?
Yeah, I mean, they talk a lot about a credit crisis. They talk about panic. They talk about other keywords that, and not all of them, to be fair, but Bernanke, who is the great historian of these types of scary financial crisis episodes, particularly the Great Depression. He talks about this, the same with Yellen. So not all of them had their eye on the prize, I would say.
Yeah.
But the likely suspects who you would expect to have cared about some of the really terrible possible scenarios were talking about it.
Felix, along those lines, Janet Yellen, the current chair of the Fed, comes off looking pretty good. She said things are going to get worse, way worse.
She called it earlier than just about anyone else. She has... One of the reasons everyone was so wanted her to be the new Fed chair is precisely because she got this episode right and much more right than anyone else on the committee.
Biggest surprise, Catherine, out of this?
Biggest surprise. That's
Take a minute. I'll go to Felix.
I don't know. No? There were a few mentions that didn't look so great. I guess there was one moment, I think, when they were calling an emergency meeting and Mishkin couldn't attend because he was on the slopes.
Mishkin, like a nice little piece of color there.
My biggest surprise was the September 16 meeting when those of us who had been covering the news all weekend realized how panicked there was. Tim Geithner, who was the president of the New York Fed, couldn't turn up because he was too busy putting out fires with AIG. And even then, even though the world was literally crumbling around our ears and Lehman had just failed and had no idea, you know, that the world was coming to an end, they kind of said, well, you know, I think maybe we might want to think about raising swap lines. You know, they just didn't understand how big of a deal it was.
This is kind of a Heisenberg question, Catherine, and you have to answer it quickly, I'm afraid, because we're almost out of time. How worrisome is it that we are all so intensely scrutinizing these minutes for the next time there's a crisis? Do you think that's going to change behavior?
I don't think so. Okay. I think there's going to be interest in this episode no matter what. Maybe we'll learn from it if heaven forbid, there is a next time.
Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, Felix Salmon from Reuters. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks,
Kai.
All right, have a good weekend. A correction now before we move on from our broadcast Tuesday about the Congressional Budget Office estimate on job losses if the minimum wage were to be raised. I was wrong when I said the CBO was talking about President Obama's plan to bump pay for new federal contract workers. The CBO report, in fact, was in reference to any plan to raise the minimum wage to $10 for all workers. On Wall Street today, you know, one of those days. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The president's budget plan is going to come out sometime in the next couple of weeks. But, of course, the way these things go, the strategic leaks have already started. So we're getting a sense of what's going to be in the thing and what isn't. The trend the past couple of years has been to have some small nugget, an olive branch, if you will, for politicians who are worried about the deficit. Not so this year, as Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington.
President Obama's most recent budget said we should address the deficit by reining in Social Security. Well, it seems that's gone. See, the deficit is not something Americans care about all the time. Carol Doherty tracks how interested voters are in the deficit for Pew.
It goes up in times when you see a great deal of attention to it.
And several groups have been trying to get us to pay attention to it. One of them is Fix the Debt, which keeps a close eye on the president's budget.
It's very symbolic, and it shows what the White House's priorities are.
That's Maya McGinnis. She's the president of Fix the Debt. And she says Americans care about the deficit when the numbers are really big.
The nation really woke up and started paying attention to the fiscal challenges when we hit trillion-dollar deficits around the economic crisis.
But a new forecast from the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, shows the deficit is down, and it's likely to stay down for a couple of years at least, which means deficit reduction probably won't be in vogue again for a while. Matt Slaughter is a professor at the Tuck School at Dartmouth.
For better or for worse, Washington tends to focus on next election or next month, not next decade.
You see, the deficit can seem abstract, and Paul Light, a politics professor at NYU, says finding a solution to big deficits will never be popular because that would require
a sacrifice from everybody, and we're not in a sacrificing mood right now.
And that probably won't change for at least one election cycle, maybe two, depending on how much faith you put in the CBO's projections. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Just because Will Ferrell and his alter ego Ron Burgundy weren't everywhere enough during the all-out product placement and PR blitz that was the release of Anchorman 2, Paramount is going to release an entire second version of the film next Friday. Not DVD here, people. In theaters, they apparently had enough extra material to replace nearly every joke in the movie, 763 of them to be precise. David Weinberg is on it.
The official title of the movie is Anchorman 2, The Legend Continues, supersized R-rated version. Rolls right off the tongue. Anyway, the original Anchorman 2 was PG-13, which means you didn't get to see this version of the scene where Ron Burgundy and his pals smoke crack on air.
Tell you, I love cocaine, so if this is anything like that...
Oh, then you're gonna love crack.
Wah, wah, wah. All right, moving right along. Movie studios generally like to avoid R ratings because they tend to make less money. But since the PG-13 version of Anchorman already came out, there's little risk in a theatrical release of an R-rated version, says RentTrack senior media analyst Paul DeGarbedian.
People who like Anchorman, they're not shy. I mean, audiences could totally handle an R-rated Ron Burgundy. There's no question about it. Probably would love to see that.
These days, it's common for studios to do a DVD release of an unrated version of a movie with raunchier jokes or more nudity, but it's never in theaters and never on this scale, replacing nearly all the jokes.
I mean, I think in some ways this is a first in the history of Hollywood.
Luis Cabral teaches economics at the NYU Stern School of Business. He says this type of joke overhaul wasn't even possible 10 to 20 years ago, but digital editing has changed that. But Cabral still doesn't expect this to become a trend. And while the new version is much longer than the original, the theatrical release is much shorter. It will only be in theaters for a week. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
We, that is Marketplace, is 25 years old this year. And one of the things we're doing to celebrate is a series we're calling 25 for 25.
25 years.
25 things.
Jobs. Revenue.
The economy.
The American people.
So, 25 things about the economy to mark those 25 years. Today's comes from a listener, Christopher Carl Johansson from Asheville, North Carolina, who asks, what is this I hear about a tenured tea note? How about reviewing from time to time in a brief summary why an invitation to tea is so important, just where this little letter is tenured, and how it got tenured? All right, so maybe I don't speak so clearly sometimes, but we had Sabri Benishore explain the 10-year tea note anyway.
A treasury bill or note is another name for a government bond. And when you buy a government bond, you're lending money to Uncle Sam. And to help us explain that, we have Krista Schwartz. She actually used to work in the office that sells treasuries.
I worked at the on the open market desk at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York.
And we have Billy.
Hello, my name's Bill. I'm a treasury bill.
He's a T-bill, just a treasury bill. Just stop.
You know what, Sabri? This is demeaning to us both.
I'm not doing this.
Are you serious? You're doing this now.
I'm not a prop, okay? I am a representative of the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. When Uncle Sam needs money, I am the IOU he gives to you.
Okay, then. Back to Krista Schwartz. The bills, bonds, and notes she used to handle, the loans to Uncle Sam, these can be for just a few days or a few decades.
The time until it's paid back, that's what you call either a 2-year security or a 10-year security.
If you buy Billy here, he's technically a note, you'll be lending Uncle Sam money for 10 years. And what do you get in return? Well, let's ask Uncle Sam.
Hello, Sabri. Hello, Bob.
It's actually Bill.
Yes, yes, Bernard.
So, Uncle Sam, what do we get for lending you money?
Interest payments, of course. Right now, the going rate is 2%. If you invest $1,000 in 10-year treasuries, I'll give you $20 a year for 10 years.
So I lend you $1,000. I get paid back in 10 years, and I get $20 a year? That's not that much.
Treasury rates are relatively low because they're considered to be very safe.
Let's just sign Billy here.
So a 10-year note like Billy is reliable and has a usually low interest rate. But why is it such a big deal that Kai talks about its price every day?
Bond prices up just a touch.
The answer is that it tells us something about the economy. Sometimes people will really, really want treasury bonds, like if they're worried about the economy and they want to put their money into something really safe. They'll bid the price of Billy and his friends up. And sometimes people won't want treasuries because the economy's great and there's better stuff to buy, and they'll dump you, Billy. Your price will fall.
That is rude.
Yeah, but you can tell a lot about where people are putting their money if you watch T-bond prices. Are prices up? Well, people are worried and playing it safe with T-bonds. Are prices down? Well, people are going out into the economy and investing. Which brings us to the second thing that Kai talks about.
The yield on the 10-year T-note. Yield on the 10-year T-note. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.68%.
The yield is how much someone will make at the end of the day if they buy a treasury like you, Billy, and hang on to it until they're paid back. The yield changes because while the price moves around each day, those payments that Uncle Sam makes...
$20 a year for 10 years.
Those don't change for you. So if your price goes up, it eats into the return. So it makes the yield lower. Or if your price goes down, it makes the return look bigger.
And so prices and yields move in opposite directions.
People should care about it for a couple of reasons.
And who's this?
This is John Elder. He is a professor at Colorado State. I brought him in because you are difficult.
These treasury bonds can also be an indicator of interest rates on loans.
Like car loans or mortgages or maybe credit cards. These are all often related to the yield on a 10-year T-note. Why? Well, because a bank can lend money to me, the consumer, or it can lend it to Uncle Sam.
As the yield on 10-year treasuries go up, you might think that, well, banks would be less willing to lend out. If I could earn, say, 4% on a U.S. Treasury, I'd be less willing to make a car loan of similar maturity at less than 4%.
So in a way, Billy competes with our car loans and our student loans and our mortgages. His yield goes up. Well, our interest rates go up. His yield goes down. Well, our rates go down, too. Because no loan is safer than a loan to Uncle Sam. So in sum, T-bills, notes, and bonds are loans to Uncle Sam, and their prices and their yields tell us about the economy. Billy, by the way, when were you issued?
Let's see, I was issued 10 years ago today.
Oh, Billy, that means your time is up. Uncle Sam is going to pay you back, and you're going to be...
destroyed! Where's Billy?
Oh, my God, I'm getting out of here.
Here's Sammy!
He's crazy.
Okay, well, good luck, Billy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
10 years to live, he's got 10 years to live. He's a bond with interest to give.
Lauren Yetzi, Mike Matlock, Tommy Vendifredo, and Jeffrey Omura helped out with that piece. You can drop us a line, tell us what you'd like to hear in our series, 25 for 25. Letters at marketplace.org is the email. At marketplaceapm is us on Twitter. Coming up.
The truth was, no one knew why the market was down. It started the day just down.
BJ Novak tells us a story, but first, let's do the numbers. Well, look, the market's down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 29 points today, nearly 0.2%, closed at 16,103. BJ Novak, where are you when I need you? The NASDAQ fell 4 points, 0.1%, finished at 4,263. The S&P 500 shed 3 points, about 0.2%. Ended things at 1836. For the week that it was, the Dow off 0.3%, the NASDAQ up 0.5%, the S&P 500 down 0.1%. The price of shares in Priceline.com jumped 2.5% today after the online travel agency said the past 3 months were better than expected, with more people booking travel for early this year. Bond prices, while they rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Museum professionals gather in Washington for Museums Advocacy Day. In Barcelona, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg is scheduled to speak on opening day of the Mobile World Congress 2014. And people, do you like piña coladas? I know here in California, we'd like to get caught in the rain. Singer-songwriter Rupert Holmes turns 67. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We all spend a lot of time at work, which makes it easy to get invested emotionally in what happens there. And sometimes stuff happens that just drives you nuts, and maybe you lose your temper, or you cry, you shed a tear or two. We're all human, you know? But emotions and the workplace don't traditionally go together all that well. Women in particular get judged all kinds of ways when they emote at the office, judged in ways that usually aren't good for their careers, as Ashley Milne-Tite reminds us.
When Caroline Turner went to work for a big beer company, she was the first woman to enter the C-suite. She was used to the stresses of corporate life. But occasionally, a situation would blow up and she'd feel that telltale lump at the back of her throat.
The first time I did it in the corporate world, I was angry. And my way of expressing anger, because I couldn't stomp and yell, was often through tears.
She always tried to quell them. These days, she runs a company called Difference Works. She counsels companies on how to use men's and women's different styles to their advantage. She still advises women to hold the tears till they get to the bathroom.
Because the workplace is based on masculine norms. So women come into the workplace with our differences, and the world has defined professionalism and leadership in that masculine way, which is leave the emotions in the parking lot.
Turner says that's a shame, but it's reality. Many women can attest that getting upset at work affects how others see you.
What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from
happening. Hillary Clinton's anger got a lot of press after her appearance at last year's hearings on the U.S. consulate attack in Benghazi. She's not the only woman to draw negative attention for losing her temper. Yale University research shows women who express anger at work are seen as less competent, less worthy of a raise, and out of control. But men who show anger, they don't lose status. Their anger is put down to external factors.
That's the issue that women have to navigate, is that in an unfair way, even if they do the exact same thing as a man, even if they display the exact same emotion, it gets interpreted differently.
That's Marianne Cooper. She's a sociologist at Stanford University. She was also the lead researcher on Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In.
My hope would be that we can work towards a system where women don't have to work so hard just to be taken seriously. That's the kind of change we need, where when people cry, it's not perceived as a weakness. It's not perceived as being too emotional.
John Gersmer says we're getting there, slowly. He's the co-author of The Athena Doctrine, How Women and the Men Who Think Like Them Will Rule the Future. For his research, he polled 64,000 people about various human values and traits. He says expressiveness is seen as a vital characteristic for a leader.
I think this is really about, you know, getting to see the true, authentic person. We're looking for leaders that are actually themselves.
He says young leaders are themselves at the office. Corporate America won't go touchy-feely overnight, but Gersmer says the time will come when we can all let a few more feelings show at work. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
BJ Novak, who you might know as a writer and actor for the television series The Office, is out with a book of short stories. It's called One More Thing, Stores and Other Stories, one of which is The Market Was Down. We got him to sit down and read it for us.
Nobody knew why the market was down that day, but it didn't stop everyone from having a theory. Yeah. Worries over Spain's role in the EU brought the market down today, said a woman on the radio. The market had an off day today due to uncertainty in oil futures, announced a man on television. The truth was, no one knew why the market was down. It started the day just down. It had an up moment for a little bit around lunch, but was still just down. Why was the market down? No reason. Well, stupid stuff. Actually, to be honest, maybe it was Spain at the beginning, but it was really only worried about Spain because it woke up looking for something to worry about. Then, before long, the market started worrying about bigger things, things that didn't seem to have an answer. If the market had never existed, would anyone miss it? Would anything really be different? Did anyone actually really care about the market, or did they just think they could make money from it? And then there were all those people who said they hated the market, and they always seemed so much cooler and better looking than the people who liked the market. Were those people right? Was the market soulless, evil, pointless, bad? The market calmed down for a minute when it pictured Warren Buffett. What an undeniably wise, lovely man Warren Buffett was. And he sure loved the market, with all his heart, without question. That made the market feel better. But then the market thought of something so sad, it made it want to kill itself. What if Warren Buffett was just wrong? This made the market feel worse than ever. The idea that an obviously wonderful old man like Warren Buffett might have wasted his heart loving something as terrible and worthless as itself, the market. Now the market felt so guilty and terrible it let itself wonder what it would be like if it let itself collapse completely. But it didn't. Oh, that's ridiculous, the market told itself. Now you're just down because you're down. Come on, look alive. The market began to pick itself up a bit. People were happy to see the market improve. Everyone was rooting for it, except for a few people who were always betting on the market to fail, but there would always be people like that. And those were people that even the people who hated the market hated. When the market realized how many people were counting on it and how many people were hoping it got better, that made it pick itself up a little more. It felt more valued, more confident. Feeling that way made it look that way, too, and that made more people treat it that way, and that made it feel that way even more. It was still down, though. Just kind of down. What time was it? It felt late. The thing was, the market could only be what it was. That's what it was, the market. Was it good? Was it bad? It wasn't its job to know. It was just its job to be what it was. As the sun started to burn its way down in the sky, the market decided to just stop thinking for a while, stop working for a while, and get some rest. The next day, the market was up.
Oh, man. BJ Novak and his short story, The Market Was Down. It was produced for us by Rico Galliano and the rest of the gang at the Public Radio Culture Show, The Dinner Party Download. More stories from BJ and a slew of other writers and celebrities at their website, dinnerpartydownload.org. And you can read BJ's entire story, The Market Was Down, at our website, marketplace.org. This final note today, in which all you have to do is take a listen to this. You hear music like that every day on this program, which is why today we are launching our Marketplace Music channel on Slacker. It's a curated station for those who love us and, more importantly, the music we play. You can stream it from our website if you like, from your phone, from anywhere you are, 24 hours a day. Check it out at marketplace.org. Just give it a try. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace, the radio program from APM. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. It was developed by JJ Yore, the program, that is, not the music. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is vice president and executive producer. We got to go. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.